From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Essayist, humorist, director, and screenwriter Nora Ephron died at 71. She won Oscar nominations for screenplays for When Harry Met Sally, Silkwood, and Sleepless in Seattle. Her most recent film was Julie and Julia. Ephron's best-selling books include I Feel Bad About My Neck and I Remember Nothing and Other Reflections. When I spoke to Nora Ephron before a studio audience at KUOW on November 19, 2010, one thing she did remember was getting her first big break in journalism at Newsweek magazine.
Big break. I was offered a job as a mail girl. And thank God I had gone to college because I really needed my degree to do that. And I went there. You know, I just was a person who wanted to be a journalist. I had read, you know, Brenda Starr comics, and I'd watched a lot of Superman, and I thought Lois Lane was very cool, and I went to one of those little vocational talks they have at school, and there was a woman who was a sports reporter at the LA Times, and she started talking about being a reporter, and I thought, simultaneously, I want to be a journalist, and at the same time, I thought it would probably be a good way to meet men. The two thoughts were just completely mushed up there together. And so I worked on the newspaper in high school and college, and I went and got this job as a mail girl. And it was 1962, and I was being interviewed, and the man interviewing me said, "Why do you want to work at Newsweek?" As if I was supposed to say, "Because I just love the magazine." So, you know, I don't know what he expected. And I said, "Well, I would like to be a writer." And he said, "There are no writers at Newsweek who are women." And so I thought, well, okay, I'll show him someday. But what was interesting about that was there actually was a woman writing at Newsweek. This did not affect what he just said to me. She had been hired during World War II, like Rosie the Riveter, when they had to hire women because they ran out of the other sex. But they were never going to have to do that again, you know. And years later, when there was a lawsuit at Newsweek and the women who were in the subservient position sued, the editor of the magazine said, "Oh, well, we don't have a policy about this. It's just the way we've always done it." He actually said that. And I looked at that and thought, but you did have a policy. I heard it with my own ears. But in any case, I was still in journalism, and I was still sort of excited and giddy, I have to say.
It took a few steps to get to writing, though, but apparently your energy was pretty high at that point.
Well, I got very lucky because I worked on a parody of the New York newspapers during the famous 114-day newspaper strike that really wasn't a strike, it was a lockout. And the editors of the New York Post read the parody. And by the way, Calvin Trillin worked on it, and a lot of people who became writers. He already was one. And the editors of the New York Post saw the parody, and they said, "Sue them." And the publisher of the Post said, "Don't be ridiculous. If they can parody the Post, they can write for it. Hire them." So that's how I got my first job as a reporter.
You talk about parodies, which I guess you've written about a dozen of them. You say it's the closest a writer gets to acting.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, because you really assume the character of the person you're parodying. I mean, you kind of parodies usually, in my case, whenever I write one, it's not coming out of love. It's usually coming out of some kind of irritation. And the last one I did was occasioned by reading the third of Stieg Larsson's books. And I was on about page 70 and realized that I had no idea where in Sweden I was. And everyone in the book had exactly the same name. They were all named Sigerson, Torkelson, Svensson. It was a nightmare of keeping everyone straight. And by the time I got to the end of the book, I was like shot out of a cannon, ready to write the parody of it.
The girl who fixed the umlaut, who I strongly recommend you look it up and check it out. Mm-hmm. It's just hysterical if you've read the books. You know, you write that you used to be in love with journalism, but it sounds like journalism broke your heart or you...
Well, I think that you know, many things have changed. And, you know, I sometimes feel about journalism, the same way I feel about email, is that it's like bumping into an old boyfriend and thinking, what did I ever see in him? And I certainly feel that about email, which I fell so in love with when it first came along. It was so thrilling that you know, about six or seven of your friends had your email address. The Democratic National Committee had not gotten it yet. When that voice said, "You've got mail," my heart leapt. And I thought, I have a letter. Someone is actually writing me something interesting. I mean, when's the last time that happened? People used to say, "Oh, it's so great. You can do all the things in email that always took you a phone call." And, you know, the burden of the phone call, the burden of actually making contact with the person that you wanted to be in contact with. Now you get this email that says, "Lunch?" That looks like it is saving time. But it is going to be 11 more emails before you have finally nailed down where lunch is and what date it's going to take place on and what time it is. That could have been done in a very simple phone call.
Nora Ephron is my guest. She's written the screenplays for When Harry Met Sally and Sleepless in Seattle. And she's also directed Julie and Julia. Let's talk a little bit about Sleepless in Seattle. Why did you choose Seattle for Sleepless in Seattle? Could it have easily been Sleepless?
I did not choose it. I rewrote that script. It came with that title. And let me tell you, I know a good title when I see one. And I wouldn't have touched that title. And it was geographically, the thing I changed was the city where the woman lived, because I wanted the city where the woman lived to be an equivalent to Seattle, on the water, at one end of the country. But I would never. I mean, Sleepless in Seattle. What a title! Isn't it great?
Beats Sleepless in Selma. You know.
Yeah, I know. Or Tucson.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you become a screenwriter?
Well, that's a long story. But in short, I was a magazine writer, and I was about 36. And there was a year when everyone in writing decided to try to write a screenplay, and I was one of them. And I was offered someone said to me, "Do you want to do a women's caper?" And weirdly enough, I had a plot in my head, a thing I knew. I had heard a rumor about a thing that had happened, about a theft, that was a very delicious story that you always heard was a true story, but it wasn't a true story. It was connected to Richard Nixon, but it had nothing to do. It wasn't true. But it was this thing I had clocked and thought, boy, that would make a great, great idea for a plot for a movie if I ever wrote a movie that needed something like that. So when someone said a women's caper, I thought, oh, great, I have the plot. And so I wrote it, and it was made into a television movie. And you know something? It was really bad. I'm not kidding. And I saw it when I was pregnant with my first kid, and I'm amazed he survived it. But because I'd had something made, somebody asked me to do another. And by the time I had done five or six scripts, I began to have an idea of what I was doing. And then I did Silkwood with Alice Arlen. And we worked with Mike Nichols, who directed it. And that was like going to film school. He taught us so much in the course of working on the script. So by the time my first movie was made, I kind of sort of began to know what I was doing. The lucky thing was that I had this moment in my life where having learned to be a journalist and learned to write for magazines, I suddenly had a new thing to learn.
You've got a chapter in I Remember Nothing about flops.
Yes.
Does it get easier to deal with flops as time went by?
The one thing that's easier about a flop, I mean, flops are hard, and I thought it would be interesting to write about them since more nonsense is written about failure than anything except old age. Old age is, you know, there are hundreds of books that tell you that getting older means you are in the best years of your life, and really you just want to wring the necks of people who say that. But the same thing is true about failure, that there's a whole raft of books about growth through failure.
Not so much.
And learning through failure. No, I don't think so. In fact, I think that often, sometimes you learn the wrong lessons. If you learn, here's the thing you learn if you fail. You could fail again. That's the thing you really learn. But, you know, you don't learn what you want to learn, which is how do I successfully avoid having another failure? That's the only lesson worth learning, it seems to me. And if you learn it the wrong way, you can really not sometimes take the chance, the next chance, because you're so afraid of the next failure. I'll tell you a thing that makes failure much easier. Ambien.
I'm speaking with Nora Ephron. Your most recent film, Julie and Juliet, one of the great films about many things, but of course about food. And I've heard that it's really, really difficult to photograph food so that it looks appetizing. And here you made a movie in which food plays such a central part. Was it a challenge to get it to look the way you wanted it?
Well, it was when I met with the cinematographers who were, you know, meeting with me and in the hopes they would direct it. One of the things I wanted to make sure of was that they knew that the food could not be given to the second unit, that the food had to be lit as carefully as the women were lit. And fortunately, Stephen Goldblatt, who was the cinematographer on it, one of the first things he said without my saying anything was, "I want to do the food." And at the beginning of the movie, Julia Child, Meryl Streep, has the sort of great Proustian moment of her life where she has her first sole meunier in France, in Rouen, on the way to Paris. And Stephen photographed that sole meunier. I practically cried. And I thought, you know, Martin Scorsese sees the rushes from his movie. He sees these 8-minute steady cam shots in the going through the kitchen of the Copacabana with waiters and plate, you know, trays and people moving through, and he thinks he's done something pretty fabulous, and I see a soul being boned and I think that's it. That's the high point of my life as a director.
You did it right.
Yes.
There. Nora Ephron, thank you so much for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
The new book
is
called I Remember Nothing. I'm Ross Reynolds, and this is KUOW 94.9 Seattle.